2-2 pitch. Swing and a long drive. Deep left. Way back. Gone.
Hello, everybody. J.J. Cooper, Austin Yamada, another of our Baseball America Prospect Deep Dives. Today, we are going to take a deep dive, a deep look into the Marlins farm system, a team that is rebuilding and has brought in a whole lot of new names over the last year, both in the front office, but also in the organization. Austin does our Marlins Top 30, did a great job with it. We're going to dive in, and we're starting right at the top. Because I would say a year and a half ago, the Marlins, you know, the Marlins have best developed pitching in recent years. You know, obviously we've seen Sandy Alcantara, we've seen a number of very prominent pitchers, but they had a kind of a two-headed monster. They had Thomas White and Noble Meyer, or they had Noble Meyer and Thomas White, depending on whatever way you wanted to line it up. Now it feels like that there is a clear number one on this Marlins list. What has Thomas White done to kind of emerge as the next big Marlins pitching prospect?
Basically everything, JJ. Everything that he's done so far in the last year or so. You know, his velocity has crept up slightly. You know, it's a lot of mid to upper 90s. His strike throwing, which was once considered sort of possibly a concern, he's been more than fine, you know, in the zone. I don't think he's ever going to be a plus strike thrower, but I think, you know, he could run league average walk rates as a starter. And as a guy that at one point was maybe a changeup over a breaking ball guy, he really tightened up his breaking ball. And now it's this vicious plus breaker. But his changeup is still, you know, above average to plus as well. So that's three plus or better pitches. Whenever we talk about, you know, on the last pod, we talked about player comps and being too aggressive with sort of player comps, but like this guy looks like Blake Snell, and I don't say that lightly. Like three plus or better pitches, enough strikes, and also like his deliveries. He's a big, slender guy. It's very whippy. It's not, you know, super force based. Like you would never project health for any starting pitcher, but there's no elevated risk here for sort of any sort of concerns like that. There's just sort of a well rounded pitching prospect from the left hand side. I know Jackson Jobe exists, but you know, I think Thomas White is sort of up there for among the best pitching prospects in the minors right now.
Right. No, this is a pitcher who right now is in that top tier. And the thing you said, like if you're comparing him to the Jobes and the Painters of the world, the one thing I would say, Painter has had a big injury, but those guys are guys who in Jobes' case has pitched in the majors, has pitched in the playoffs already now. You know, in Painter's case, will pitch in the big leagues this year. We expect has, you know, had success at double A, you know, kind of a little bit longer track AFL, all that. That's really, as you're saying, like you don't have to project with Thomas White really, do you? It's just more like, just keep doing this as you climb the levels and please, we're begging you stay healthy. That's really the concerns, the questions, what you want to see from him. It's not like, oh, well, he's really got to develop that control. Although, you know, that is probably, the biggest thing that could take a further step forward?
I mean, you know, if he could get into that sort of above average strike throwing guy, I think, you know, you would love for that to happen, but you know, he ran a 3.0 watts per nine at high A this year across 62 innings. Like there's really nothing wrong with that, especially at his age and with the way he's striking out as many guys as he is. He's, you know, guys aren't making contact, so there's not a lot of early ball in play stuff. He's forced to go deep into counts against guys. Would I love him to throw more strikes? Of course, but I no longer see that as even sort of a flaw of his profile. There's just really not many flaws here.
So as you said, Blake Snell type comparisons, this is a guy who really could be, if it all clicks right, that front of the rotation ace. There are other things that you mentioned. He's showing aptitude as well. Like one of the things about a pitcher that you want to see, especially nowadays, because you know nowadays one of the fun things about spring training, it used to be spring training is when pitchers would arrive and they would basically shake out their arm and they go, okay, let's get to this. And the whole goal was, you would start from February until the end of March. And it was like, by opening day, I'll have this arm ready to go. Nowadays, pitchers are like, I've spent the offseason and I've added this, or now I can do this. But that's not easy always. That's something that some pitchers are better at than others. As you mentioned, Thomas White has already shown some of those aspects, right? Like being able to refine a pitch, add a pitch, improve a pitch also is a marker that you might be able to do that again, because this is a game of move, counter move, where as hitters adjust to you, you have to show something new a lot of times. But he's shown that already in some ways, hasn't he?
Yeah. Yeah. He went, I assume it was in the offseason this past, you know, the 23 to 24 offseason. I assume he worked on command and breaking ball shape and all these other things, but there was no obvious bump. You know, he came in first, you know, first full season, and he, you know, dominated low A and high A at age 19. You know, his strength only actually got better as he rose levels and sort of as the season went on. You know, didn't allow runs at either stop and was striking out 11 per nine. Like what more could you ask for in a pro debut or first full season, I should say.
And that slider that he's refined / developed is really now, I mean, that could be one of the best pitches in the majors someday. I feel like it's become a truly nasty pitch already, hasn't it?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Especially from his, like, it's kind of a low whippy, it's not a sidearm slot, but it's a lower three quarters crossfire slot with coming off the fastball that rides up and away, and then you have the slider. Like it plays versus both sides. Like that two pitch mix is enough to get either side out, and then you add the changeup that he had on top of that. It's just, you know, a guy that could run really high strikeout rates in the majors.
So he's number one, but I do want to also talk about Noble Meyer. Mm-hmm. Noble Meyer, I feel like, kind of comes into 25 with a little bit of a lengthier to-do list. There's more that has to happen here with Meyer for him to kind of ascend to that one of the best pitching prospects in baseball. What have they seen from Meyer, and what do they need to see going forward with Meyer if he's going to kind of catch up or try to catch back up close to it to Thomas White?
Yeah, I think we have Meyer in a good spot right now, because I think if you just, you know, went to sleep in a time capsule from the moment he was drafted till now, you would say, I can't believe sort of he's being regarded as he is. But on the flip side, if you knew nothing about his track record and you just saw his pro track, like what he's done in the pros, and you just sort of like watched him throw, you would say, I don't understand how he's as high as he is. So I think we have him in the right spot. Sort of anyone who's followed Noble Meyer as an amateur, he was, you know, an all world, one of the can't miss high school pitching prospects. And, you know, he's got stuff now and projectability, and he's got size. He's sort of like the prototypical dream right-handed high school pitcher. But, you know, as demographics go, these high school right-handed pitchers are just kind of a risky proposition. And you can see with Noble Meyer, he walked 7 per 9 this past year, and he did not
throw
strikes.
That's too many.
And he walked a ton in his pro debut too. We have no sample yet at any level in the pros of him throwing even close to presentable amount of strikes. And you talk about it, you know, let's talk about a pitching prospect that's walking 4.5 per 9. You're saying that's too high for a starting pitcher. He's got to cut it down by a full walk per nine, right? Well, if you cut Noble Meyer's down by a full walk, he's walking 6 per 9. You would have to.
If you cut it in half, it's too much.
It's right at that line. Yeah. Yeah. And so, like, you look at historical precedents for guys that walk this much and turn into major league starting pitchers, it's really, really short. You know, like the guys that are walking 7 per 9, it is hard to imagine him making such a leap that he can get into that presentable range.
I could come up with Randy Johnson early in his career, and I may be about out of the list. Because again, if you said relievers, like the Craig Kimbrels of the world, there are more of these, but yeah, it's really, no, you're so, but the weird part about this is okay. Is there something, like you said, when you talk to people, when you watch video of Noble Meyer, is there something in his delivery where you're like, oh, you're never going to be able to repeat that. Oh, or his arm's always too late, too early. You know, it's not synced up. Is there some aspect where you're like, this is the problem here? Or is it just inconsistency scattershot where it's kind of a variety of things?
Yeah, that's kind of the thing, is like, that's perplexing. It's like his mechanics are a little inconsistent, and sometimes he'll yank the front shoulder a bit, but it's not a terrible delivery. It's not like he looks uncoordinated. It's not like Sort of like, I can't foresee him. Like, there's no reason, if you watched him for two innings and he walked one batter, you wouldn't think this is a guy that's walking 7 for 9. And I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, right? If it's a good thing that he like sort of looks like he can throw strikes, or a bad thing that there's nothing to fix, because it's really hard to pinpoint why he's not throwing strikes.
I've spent a lot of time watching Connor Phillips with the Reds over the last couple of years, because he has really great stuff, and then he has real consistency with his delivery. You can 100% understand why there are innings where it's like, oh, he just doesn't know where it's going, because it is, there are a couple of things, but like staying in sync, you know, being on time in his delivery is really a challenge for him. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know either. Is it good that it's like there's no clear, discernible, glaring flaw, or is it bad because if you're walking 7 per 9 with the delivery that's reasonably consistent, are there tolerance ranges, you know, that go beyond the range of the error bars are too wide here, where every little aspect of this just varies too much? I don't know. I'm not smart enough to know that. But those are the pitching prospects who stand out. But this is a team that's also, I would say, worked really hard recently to bring in position players. And I will say, if you have not looked at the Marlins' projected lineup for this year, this is a team that needs that, because this is a team that has a number of positions where I would say that their opening day starter is someone who I would say a lot of teams would project as a backup or a AAA player, not a big league regular. Big picture, kind of looking at this, Austin, so what kind of, when they did all these trades, Starlin Cava, who they just, you know, they added the Jesus Cesaro trade, is a top 100 prospect. He's the only one they added, though. Augustin Ramirez is kind of a fringe of the 100. I don't want to, like, there's not a big difference between being 90 and not being on that list for a guy like Augustin Ramirez. But it feels like that they went for volume and depth and having a wide array of possible options here, more than it is we're going to put all of our chips into getting this one star prospect in this trade or whatever. Kind of how do you perceive it? Like, is this, do they have a lot of depth now? Because they haven't had that in a lot. Or are there a lot of potential regulars here? Projected regulars? Guys who have a puncher's chance of being regulars? What did they bring in these trades?
Yeah, I think you said it well. Before I say this, I don't want to speak for the Marlins, nor do I want to speak for the teams they traded for, because, you know, I don't know what's in their mind. But I will say it does feel from the outside like they were targeting the most amount of value rather than the specific players that their scouts were high on or their front office was high on. It does, with the exception of, I know the Padres did really like Jacob Marcy and Graham Pauly. And so, like, there were a couple Padres names that I think they got that the Marlins specifically liked. And, you know, I could probably find a couple other names in there. But for the most part, it does kind of feel like they were trying to get the most, you know, add up the cents to the most dollars rather than, but maybe take guys that the other team was sort of willing to give up if that's the cost of doing business. And again, I don't want to speak for each individual trade or, you know, the front up, but that it does feel that way. And sort of it kind of goes along with the fact that, you know, Bendix took over and it's a whole new, you know, there's a lot of turnover in the front office. There's not a lot of established systems or trusted evaluators for them to sort of say, like, there's a track record here. If, you know, this guy likes this guy, we need to go get him. So it does kind of feel like they went more of a industry value model based sort of, you know, these, let's go get enough and see who sticks. And like you said, I don't think they got too many slam dunk plus projected regulars. I think they got a lot of guys who could maybe turn into bench or average regulars if everything breaks right. The one benefit I think I will say, well, besides the fact that they haven't historically been able to develop hitting prospects well themselves internally, so why not go get guys that are already half developed? But then also I think the sort of the benefit is I always talk about, like, available playing time is a resource in itself. And not every team can afford that. Like the Dodgers and the Phillies, they cannot afford to give away 500 plate appearances to a minor league player that probably won't be good in his first year. And I think it's easy to forget, people overreact to the first 500 plate appearances, but it's hard for a major league hitter to face major league pitching for the first 500 plate appearances and be good. And I think a lot of prospects sort of, don't get afforded this 2 to 3 year window to really develop. And it's really hard to know what they would become in a different org because they were just pushed out after. And so the fact that the Marlins don't have sort of these established cornerstones might be a good thing, you know, that it affords them, and they're not trying to contend this year. It affords them a lot of playing time to these guys to see who sticks and sort of give them more leash than another org might.
Let me give you two examples of that. I completely agree with you. For one, let's look at a Marlins example. You said like that they traded for guys who the other team might be willing to let go. Xavier Edwards, who was arguably the best Marlins hitter in the second half of last season, fits that perfectly, right? Like he was not going to play for the Rays. Why? Because the Rays had a ton of other guys. He was kind of stuck at the upper levels of that system. And it's like, we don't have at-bats. He goes to the Marlins and they're like, we have at-bats in abundance. And he goes out, takes advantage of it, and has a really good season. And now absolutely fits in their plans. And by the way, playing shortstop, a position that he kind of had, when going back to the Padres, he was a shortstop. But as a Ray, it's like, no, he's a second baseman. He's a third baseman. Now he's maybe a shortstop. Okay, so that's value out of that. To take another example of an organization, you say, well, what's an example of this? I would just say, look at last year's, at the time, Oakland A's, right? Brent Rooker's been known about for a very long time. There is no one in baseball who's like, who's Brent Rooker? He was a SEC star, but there's always been that question of not great defensively. Is he going to hit enough to be kind of just a bat? Well, the answer last year was yes. Okay, well, that was one example, but they had number of examples of that for the A's. Playing time can help you develop a guy. Lawrence Butler kind of had a longer runway with the A's than he would have, like you said, for the Dodgers, the Phillies, the Orioles, the teams like that. That does sometimes give an opportunity for a player to kind of take that next step. And if you're a Marlins fan who wants to have an optimistic view of 2025, there is no one in this lineup, except for maybe Xavier Edwards, because he did it last year. There's no one who you're like, well, this guy can't play because this guy's just blocking him and no one is standing in his way. So when I kind of asked that, though, like looking at that, who are a couple of these guys who could take advantage of that? Do they have prospects in this organization who you're like, you know, again, we Connor Norby, I don't want to describe as a graduated prospect, but we'll see in this year. And I think especially we'll see where does he fit defensively. I think there's less question about the bat. But and again, we're not talking about the Jonah Brides and the Matt Mervises even of those worlds, other guys like that. But is there a minor leaguer, there are prospects still, guys in our top 30 here who could really take advantage of these opportunities? We'll get to that right after this quick break.
At Matalan, it's time for another exclusive deal. Matalan Me members get 20% off when you spend £30 or more. And yes, that includes sale and selected brands. Is it time for a little payday treat? Visit matalan.co.uk to access your discount. Shop in-store and online. T's and C's apply.
And we're back. So Austin, as you look at this, are there position prospects, guys they acquired or coming up just through the system, who could take advantage of these at-bats, these opportunities that we talked about in 25?
Yeah. So I think there are two sort of big ones that stand out. One is the catcher spot. And then two is if injuries or trades happen, sort of giving Adam Mazur and Robbie Snelling sort of a round two, a do-over at their major league debuts. Let's go over the catchers first, because I don't think the Marlins have sort of a catcher of the future on their major league roster right now. So we could talk about Joe Mack and
Can I just interject? As someone who loves the Rule 5 draft, I can remember the last time the D-backs, like 10 years ago when they had no catching, drafted a Rays catcher from low A. And they basically went into the season saying, we expect him to be one of our starting, either our starting or a backup catcher. And I believe that's the last time that a team ever said, this Rule 5 catcher is just probably on the roster. Liam Hicks could be that guy this year. But I would say with that, Liam Hicks is not putting up a fortress that says no other catcher can cross this barrier. I don't think Nick Fortes either. Sorry to interject, but the door is open for maybe a Joe Mack or Augustin Ramirez, I guess is what I would be saying here.
Yeah, yeah. And I think regardless of how well Hicks does, I think you would expect to see Ramirez, if not Ramirez and Mack, by midway of the season or earlier, probably earlier than that. Ramirez, we can talk about both of them briefly because they're sort of opposite sides of a coin. Ramirez was acquired in the trade with the Yankees at the midseason last year. Joe Mack is actually one of the few
Jazz Chisholm, homegrown the prospects. Jazz Chisholm trade.
Jazz Chisholm, yep. And then Mack is actually one of the few homegrown prospects that's in their sort of top 10 to 12. Mack is sort of a slow burn, you know, was kind of hyped as a high schooler, and then he struggled, and then he's kind of a slow burn, has had a breakout this past year, added a lot of power, a good defender. Just we're not sure about the hit tool. It's sort of like 1 year of power with okay hit after many years of not hitting. And then you have Augustin Ramirez who can really hit and sort of has a combination of hit and power, but is not a good defender. I'm not even sure he'll be a catcher in any capacity 5 years from now. He might, but he could either transition to first or left or DH, or he could be one of these modern, you know, third catchers in a roster that sort of catches based on matchup or whatnot. But I think it's a bit unlikely that he is going to be an everyday catch 120 games kind of guy. Now, like we talked about, they have the playing time to do it. You want to try and give Augustin Ramirez the chance to turn into that. Because the upside is so high with his bat. But I think the nice combination of Mack, the good defender, Augustin Ramirez, the above average hitter, one lefty, one righty, you know, one can hit better and one can defend better. It's a nice sort of platoon type to just have both give a lot of playing time to.
And again, especially early on, like I love the idea of maybe saying, okay, hey, Mack is going to catch a lot. And Ramirez kind of starts with, look, we're not going to ask you to go back there. Sandy, you know, Sandy's on the mound tonight. We're not going to ask you to catch that kind of velo, that kind of stuff tonight. You're going to DH tonight. Oh, we got a good matchup today. Oh, Adam Mazur's on the mound. Okay. Well, today maybe we're going to let you, you know, let you kind of catch that kind of situation where picking spots for him. But as you said, even if Ramirez hits the way that he can, he could be a valuable kind of catcher, kind of first baseman, kind of left fielder, kind of DH. Like, you know, that for especially for this team, that could be that kind of batting average and power, the on base percentage and power could be really useful. Okay, but you said you also wanted to, you know, like there's also kind of the pitching version of this as well, is there not?
Yeah. So Robbie Snelling and Adam Mazur were both acquired from the Padres. And both really struggled in their did Snelling make his debut?
He didn't make his debut. He just struggled in the minors.
Yeah, yeah. He struggled. He was actually better after the trade, but he really struggled in the first half with the Padres. And then Mazur was hit around quite a bit in his major league debut.
7.49 ERA.
Yeah. But both of them are basically at the, you know, knocking on the door of the majors. They could easily break camp with the club or, you know, if injuries happened, if not come up sooner. So one thing I'll say about Augustin Ramirez, I did just talk about how playing time is a valuable resource, but it might be a bit different with your poor defensive catcher, because keep in mind, like this whole team is rebuilding. If they trade Sandy and maybe Quantrill goes away too, and their rotation is now, let's call it Ryan Weathers, Edward Cabrera, Max Meyer, Robbie Snelling, Adam Mazur. That's five starting pitchers, young starting pitchers they want to develop. Is it good for their pitching development if you have a butcher behind the plate? Maybe not. So that's another thing to consider.
No, that's a very fair point there. The other guy who I find fascinating here, PJ Morlando, he ranks eighth on this list now. He ranks seventh in our handbook before another trade. He is a guy who, when you talk about homegrown guys who could pop, I feel like that this is an extremely high variance prospect right now, which, like, what do you kind of perceive as what he could be And what are the risks of him not reaching what I would say is a pretty lofty ceiling?
Yeah, so I'm not really sure what made Morlando drop so much leading up into this, because he's been known for a while on the showcase circuit. One of the top, one of the top offensive prospects in his class a year or two ahead of the draft. And sort of, I don't know if it's prospect fatigue or what, but he sort of drifted down the boards as the draft year went on. And it honestly got to the point that at the time of the draft, like, some people thought Morlando was a reach where he was. A lot of publications, including ours, had Carter Johnson, I believe, above Morlando at the time of the draft. But, talking to the Marlins, they did have Morlando as the higher guy on their board. Morlando was like, when their pick came, Morlando was the highest guy on their board, and they took him. And you could argue that maybe they're sort of more bullish on Morlando in a way that the rest of the industry isn't. But, just talking to their amateur director and people around them, the amateur scout that saw Morlando, they think he can run. I'm not sure I totally agree, but
that's a key thing, that they really do think that there's more foot speed here than a lot of others, I feel like.
Yeah, they think there's more secondary tools in general. I think most people saw him as a first base only guy. And most of the showcases and stuff, he's been playing first in deference to other outfield prospects. But they plan on running him out, or at least so I've heard, as a center fielder next year. They don't necessarily think he's going to be a center fielder long term, but they'd rather start him at the top of the spectrum and move him down. And I think if you sort of hedge the middle, he's not as athletic as they think, but he's more athletic than the rest of the industry thinks, he could be he has a pretty good arm. He could be an everyday right fielder. And also they're sort of optimistic that his prodigious game power, batting practice power, I think he won a home run derby.
He put on a show at the home run derby that I watched.
Yeah. And so there were some concerns that it wasn't quite getting there in game. They've done something with his load. He has a really wide base, and they're trying to sort of, make him a little taller, just because he's so deep already with not a lot to sort of coil. And they're optimistic that change will get him to more game power. So I think there's a lot of reasons for optimism here. And he is the kind of guy that, like we said, despite a really good farm system, sort of the 2 through 10 isn't quite as good of a farm as maybe some other similarly ranked farm systems. Morlando is a guy that could really move up this list a year from now. If he goes out to full season ball and he hits the way we think he could hit with average and power and some plate discipline, and he's playing center field, even if he's not playing
good
center field.
He's a possible left or right fielder from that.
Yeah.
That'd be a big deal, wouldn't it?
Oh, for sure. Even if he's not playing a good center field, just the fact that he's running out there with center field on his name, he's going to skyrocket up the prospect rankings. That's just how this thing goes. And then the scouts sort of are anchored to this new, okay, he's not a good center fielder, but maybe he can be, like you said, an average corner outfielder with the bat at how young he is. There's a lot of upside here.
Normally we kind of like to say, okay, so let's talk about a non-top 10 prospect or two. We're not even get to that point yet, because again, this is a system where the depth is much more interesting than the top of the system. I want to start it with a guy, which is another trade acquisition. Devison De Los Santos led the minors in homers last year. You've already mentioned about how big league at bats are, for many cases, a scarce resource. But for the Marlins this year, they're a little less valuable. They're a little more available than others. Could you make the case, or could I make the case? Am I crazy to think that just telling Devison De Los Santos, here's first base, if you strike out 5 times today, we're going to put you in the lineup again tomorrow because we believe in you. Is there a path where he ends up being a useful big leaguer, or is the swing and miss, the hit tool questions, just too much to really even hope on that minor league power carrying over to the big leagues?
I think the power will carry over when he makes contact, but I think there are a lot of reasons to be skeptical. You might ask, a guy who's pretty young, who put up these kind of production multiple times at multiple levels, why is he ranked where he is? But I think if you talk to a lot of people in the industry, there's a lot of skepticism, and we have some anchoring points, right? He was Rule 5 eligible, and he was left off the, he was left available to be taken, and he got drafted and then returned immediately. And yes, he was traded after a good season, and he did lose weight this past. Like, there are reasons to think that he's a better prospect than he was when he was unprotected. But, you know, we have some points that he was available for very cheap.
Yes, he's been moved around, and there's never been a point where a team has been like, no, you cannot have Deficit De Los Santos.
Yeah. I do think, I don't know anything about his work ethic, but the fact that he lost a bunch of weight and got in better shape this year is, I think, a really good data point for, you know, maybe things that he can work on. And he's still so young. Like, he's not your 27-year-old quad A guy. Like, he's quite young. But, you know, besides the power, you do have to talk about, like, usually, even if you're a super well-rounded bat, if you're a first base only guy, you're still not that valuable because you really have to hit. But then you talk about, on top of the fact that he's first base only, like, he has a lot of chase and he has a lot of whiff. Not just one of the, he has both, and he has a lot of trouble recognizing spin. So you can't recognize breaking balls. He chases a lot and he whiffs a lot. So, like, there could be some really ugly, you know, just at bats where it's three straight sliders in the dirt.
And he can't run, and he's not a good defender. We talk about five-tool players. De Los Santos is not a one-tool player because the arms actually, you know, that was one thing that kind of kept him at third base for a while. But he's a two-tool player, right? Like, I mean, the hit tool, the run, the field are all below average at best.
And the arm doesn't do much at first base.
A lot on the bat, a lot on the power. I mean, the guys who make this work, like, it's kind of a Matt Davidson profile.
Yep.
To me.
That's a good one. Yeah, I agree. That's a really good comparison. And I think I need to go back and check, but I think Davidson walked more at every level than De Los Santos has. So, but you know, De Los Santos is been young for the level, and like, why would he change up his profile when he's mashing the way that he has? So, like, you know, just to give fairness to him, outside of 2023, he's really hit at pretty much every other year, and you know, at young levels.
He will turn 22 midway through the season. So, like you said, this is not a finished product, and he has shown some willingness, ability to put in the work too. But as you said, like, this is the kind of the theme of this. Almost every one of these guys has some really interesting attributes. But like, if you say, okay, well, why? I'll even start with Starlin Cabo. Why would the Phillies trade away the best defensive young shortstop prospect in the minors? Because we don't know how well he's going to hit. Why would the Yankees trade away Augustin Ramirez, who has a pretty good track record of hitting? Because they didn't think he could catch, and they were like, we've got Austin Wells. We got guys who are better than him. Why would the D-backs give up Devenson De Los Santos? It's like, because Adrian Del Castillo is kind of a better version in our mind of him. There's a lot of these, right? Like, there's a lot of these where it's like, you could make the case of why the Marlins would want him, but you could also make the case of, but I also understand why they were available in trade. Who are some other guys who kind of stand out to you, though, like, are keeping, you know, interesting guys as we go further down in the system, which is, as we said, pretty deep now?
Yep. There's a lot of guys outside of, you know, the top 10 that are worth highlighting, even as deep as I could have gone 40 deep. And then they made trades after we sort of had our first draft, you know, with the Rangers trade and the Phillies trade. But just to go through some names, a name that I really like, Aiden May, one of their, I think he was their third rounder, I want to say, this past draft, the 2024 draft. Kind of looks like Walker Buehler, just in terms of like the build and the whippy arm, and he's mid-90s fastball with a big frisbee slider. You know, if he can get lefties out, he's potentially a mid-rotation guy.
And like Walker Buehler, kind of came into pro ball with a little bit of like, oh, there's a forearm injury, you know, kind of like component too, which Walker Buehler, you know, like, there was some of how hurt is he when he was coming out of Vanderbilt.
Right. Another one is a lefty starting pitcher, Keener Benitez, has sort of like has some flashes of Francisco Liriano. He's a really slender young lefty. fastball from the left hand, kind of slingy, low three-quarter slot fastball up to the mid-90s with a promising changeup and slider. Rare that you see this level of feel for a changeup with command and with separation at this age that Benitez has had. And as one of the youngest pitchers at full season ball didn't just tread water, but was actually very good. He started the last season at age 17, and he spent most of the season in full season ball, struck out over a batter per inning, and very projectable. Andres Valor, international, really good body. Another one of our BA staffers, Josh Norris, has seen Valor live and raved. Plus speed, can probably stay in center, has some George Springer aspects to him, can electric bat speed. If he does gain more strength, he may move to a corner, but then he's going to hit for a lot of power. If he stays as lethal as he currently is, then you have this plus runner, plus defender in center. There's a lot of interesting names here.
You mentioned Carter Johnson and whatnot before also, which was a guy who was their second round pick last year, who I mean could be an everyday regular middle infielder down the road if everything clicks right.
Yes. I will say we started Carter Johnson in this process higher on their top 10 or on their top 30. We had him above Morlando originally as we sort of did more digging and asking around. He is what they look like, right? He has a smooth swing from the left-handed side. He's a middle infielder. He looks like Bryson Stott in a lot of ways. And he's got a nice track record, but sort of you see a bunch of well-rounded attributes that does a lot of things kind of well, but he doesn't really do anything really well. He's probably not a shortstop full-time. He's not a great athlete. He didn't hit for much power. The hit tool isn't even like his line drive rates, his barrel rates. Yeah. Yeah. And so, I think I came away by the end of our top 30 process lower on Carter Johnson, than I thought I might.
He has a lengthier to-do list. Like we'll see what he does in 25, but it's like, yeah, he needs to get a little stronger. He needs to get a little better defensively. There's just a lot of things where it's like, this is again, like there's a, one of the things that I love about this is like all these, when we talk about this, when we talk about this for a major leaguer, there are still error bars around. Like if you said right now, how is Shohei Ohtani going to perform in 2025? The error bars of like, if you said, oh, I think he's going to hit 50 homers and someone else said, I think he's going to hit 40. Someone else said, I think he's going to get hurt. Someone hit 30. We don't know on Shohei Ohtani. Now we're talking about 19-year-olds. The error bars, but what I'm kind of interpreting what you're saying there is that when he was drafted, when we started this process, you think, okay, that may be a 6 hit. And it's like, actually, maybe it's a 55. That may be a 5 field. Okay, maybe it's a 45. It could still end up being a 50. We're not saying it can't, but we're saying it feels more like it might end up being a 45. And that half grade difference can be really crucial at the end of the day. Can it often like, is that, but a lot of times we could be, a guy could be a grade or two grades different than what we're, especially when we talk about things like the hit tool and all, where we're having to massively project because no one other than maybe a Juan Soto is a 50 hitter as an 18-year-old, as far as a major league grade of these kind of things.
Yeah. And I think it's important to remember, like put our egos in check that none of us are as good at predicting the future as we think we are. I will say with Carter Johnson specifically, I have more optimism with sort of like a guy with a young baseball training age who just picked up the sport more recently, or maybe an international sign that sort of didn't have proper nutrition. And is, you know, the fact that Carter Johnson has been around a while and is sort of like this has been a prospect for a while, like with a lack of big tools, I'm less confident that Carter Johnson is going to, you know, turn into a 60 or 70 in some tool than maybe a different player. But like, I do think it's a good point that usually prospect disappoint us, but there are, you know, random players that, you know, did anyone think Jose Altuve or Jose Ramirez was going to hit for 70 game power? Like I didn't. So I think it's one of those things. And like, at least Ramirez had tools, but like Altuve was not a big toolsy guy. He was hitting 400, staring us in the face as a minor leaguer, and no one really believed. So I do think, yeah.
But he did it at Lancaster, which is the greatest. Lancaster is the greatest, like, I don't know what to do with this. Like, because he did that, and then guys like John Gaston did that. And you're like, okay, how much of this is Lancaster too? And it's like, yeah, again, Altuve, it's incredible what he did. Yeah. When you look at this, kind of wrapping a bow on this, when you look at this Marlins system right now, I still feel like they're far away. Like you said, like there's an opportunity here in 25 to try to find 2, 3, 4 long-term pieces. Well, probably, let's be honest, maybe even showcasing a couple of others to make the next trades. But I look at this team right now, and it's hard for me to say how this team could be good in 26. I will say 27 is far enough away that it, but if they're not going to spend, which is normally not something the Marlins do, it's really hard for me to even say for 27, like, oh, this is how this will get to 85 plus wins. Is this team still kind of at the starting point of a rebuild, as it feels like, as you're looking at both the big league lineup, but also kind of the farm system here?
Unfortunately, JJ, I think it is. I agree with you. I do think, like, they're so far away that it seems really hard to see this being a shorter rebuild. This does feel like the start of a longer rebuild. I will say we've been kind of pessimistic throughout the pod, and I just want to end it on a couple sort of like positive notes for any like Marlins fans listening. One is, as we talked about, well, I wanted to also touch on, there was one name I neglected to talk about when we were talking about interesting guys. I think at the sort of at the front end of prospect deals, you're going to sort of go for the bulk value, but a guy that they got slipped into the back of the Jazz Chisholm trade was Abrahan Ramirez, a young second baseman, middle infielder that I think I'm really high on, twitchy on the smaller side, but really, really good plate discipline. You know, he on-based 450 last year. You know, he is an above average runner. He can handle the middle infield. He has hit, he has power, more power than his 150 pound frame would say. And if he does get bigger, you know, I think he'll still be an average runner and a fine defender at second, but you know, you go along with the hit and the plate discipline, and then he starts hitting for power. So I wanted to touch on him because I forgot earlier. And then, the last point I wanted to make is, you look at sort of where the Marlins had been, which was a rebuilding team that had some interesting pitchers and not much else, but then their farm wasn't good either. And yes, they didn't really acquire any slam dunk prospects. And outside of Thomas White, they don't really have a second slam dunk prospect. But just having this many bites at the apple is a really good thing that they didn't have at this point last year. And a good example is, if you look at our top 10 for the Marlins last year, most of those guys did not make the top 30. Or, you know, we're put, like Victor Mesa Jr. did not have a bad season. I would say he had at least a decent season. And he went from the top 10 to he's in the middle or back. He's at the back end of our top 30 through no
he's
fault of
30
his own.
He's 30 in our updated list. Our updated list now has him 30 after all these trades.
And it's not like his stock really went meaningfully down. They just added a lot of good prospects in between sort of where he was and where he is now, because you look at some guys that actually had poor seasons, like Carson Milbrandt, or whether they fell out of the top 30. So like, it's just a testament to sort of how many depth prospects they've added over the last year.
If you're looking at this on the YouTube, I'm posting with this, the top 10 from last year's top, you know, Marlins list. And as you said, like some of these guys, okay, Max Myers graduated, Xavier Edwards, we talked about, Xavier Edwards had a really good year. But there's a number of these guys who they were there because you got to rank a top 10, even if you don't have 10. Jacob Berry, the Jacob Berry write-up from last year, there was some skepticism. Guys like that, as you said, this was a system that didn't have, let's just be honest, didn't have 30 prospects that projected as big leaguers last year. I think that is absolutely, you're right. That is something that has changed now. There's still a lot of work to do, but that being said, like, and again, like the thing about it is now it's like, okay, can they bring another wave of pitchers? You know, you said they've got Thomas White, but it wasn't that long ago that they had Yuri Perez and they had, you know, a Max Meyer, and they had, you know, guys who were still young. Yeah, who are young in the big leagues. They got to hold on to some of those guys. They got to keep building some of those guys. But yes, they also, they need more hitters. And they've at least got some guys who will see what they can be this year. It'll be interesting to see it. You know, we check this out. Check out if you're enjoying this deep dive. I think you'll also probably enjoy. We've got a lot of other deep dives. We're almost done with all 30 organizations. We've done one of these for every organization. And if we haven't done your favorite organization yet, don't worry, it's coming because we are nearing the end of this 6 week or so project. Thank you for joining me, Austin. It's been fun talking about a very interesting system, if not one that's particularly top heavy, deeper, wider rather than top heavy. But for Austin, I'm JJ. So long, everybody.